Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, in the second part of our program, Dan Oldstein. Oldstein is an investigative reporter, a former senior editor of UPI, and a graduate of Yale, and one of the founding staff members of USA Today. We're going to talk about a look at the CDC's recent release of national statistics on autism and the debate against genes as the sole cause of it. But more importantly today, I'm going to take on some issues that when monitoring the various programs, I'm concerned that there's not intelligent debate. For example, the whole idea of those who believe in, well, everyone for themselves, what is known as objectivism, and that this is the way we should go. Alan Greenspan, yes. Nathaniel Brandon, the people who believe that nothing should deter a person from being able to achieve what they want in life with no encumbrances, no regulations, all right? There's a consequence to that. Let's discuss that. I will give you my insights and Gary Weiss from Alternet. And then last evening on Bill O'Reilly, he had two guests on, two people within the Christian religions, one a Catholic, one a, I think a Methodist, talking about should they be able to sermonize and proselytize for a given politician or political party as a part of their ministry. Hello, this has been going on for decades. And they said, yes, we're not just a member of a religion, we're individuals and we have our freedom of speech. And O'Reilly just didn't seem to understand how to challenge it. And they kept bringing everything back to the Bible. The Bible says. Okay. Be careful about a door you open when you want to support your own argument. Today, from myself and Valerie Terrico from Alternet, we're going to talk about what exactly is this whole notion of Christian morality and why are so many people hung up about sex? Do they really actually read the Bible? Do they know what it says? So let's take a look at all those people out there today who are bashing and trashing and moralizing. When they had people on last night, oh, should we legalize, you know, prostitution or marijuana? Oh, no. And why? Well, you know, one leads to something worse, does it? Do you ever look at the consequences of what happens when you have a failed 40-year war on drugs? Oh, I forgot. You don't look at any of your wars or the consequences. You refuse to examine the truth of Vietnam, of Grenada, of any of our incursions. Well, we will today. I'm going to take you on a tour of the Bible. Not to encourage or discourage you in your beliefs. That's not my business. That's not my right. But rather for those people who use the Bible to proclaim that they are justified in their attacks against gays or against women's birthrights. A talk back on that. Also, to the techies, to many of the people, including those who are supporting the 99% against the 1%, boy, that's a myth that someday someone will be honest enough to separate out. For all the Occupy people, you live by your technology. You live by your little iPads, iPhones. Are you willing to give them up if I can prove to you that they were made with slave labor and that Steve Jobs, rather than being this brilliant, genius, great human being who deserved all the credit he received in life or in death, is a psychopath, a person who is greedy in the extreme and knew full well that he was making a ton of money but on slavery. Will that change your mind? I bet it won't, because of how much hypocrisy you live with. But we're going to call you out on it. For those of you who still listen, oh, yes, Vaccines are necessary. They're safe. After all, we got rid of polio because of vaccines. Did we? Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, medical doctor, board certified, will challenge that. So you see, we have a lot to talk about today. Let's get started. First up, the whole idea of vaccines. I'm going to post today on all my sites a very comprehensive article. It's 26 pages long, and it has charts. These charts are actual public health charts that shows, for example, the mortality level of measles in England and Wales from 1901 to 1999. It's literally a 100-year historical examination, and these are not made by any single doctor. These are the public health departments. These have been published in the American Journal of Public Health. So why is it that if we have all this evidence, the evidence clearly shows that no vaccine eradicated any disease, because the vaccines weren't even introduced when 95% of the death from these diseases were gone. But let me just quote the front of this for you. Quote, vaccines did not save us. Two centuries of official statistics prove this. Introduction. This is the data the drug industry does not want you to see. Here, two centuries of United Kingdom, USA, and Australian official death statistics show conclusively and scientifically that modern medicine is not, I repeat, not responsible for and played little part in substantially improving the survival rates. The main advances in combating disease over the last 200 years, not vaccines at all, but rather better food, better variety of food, cleaner drinking water, pasteurization of milk, improved sanitation, less overcrowding, better living conditions, and end of child labor. These also borne out in published peer-review research. And then it cites the different studies from universities and from peer-review literature. Measles mortality graphs are enlightening and shows that vaccines have saved millions of lives. It is an unscientific claim which the data show is untrue. Here you also learn why vaccinations like mumps and rubella for children are medically unethical and can expose medical professionals' liability for criminal proceedings and civil damages for administering them. Then it goes into each of the different vaccines and how none of these vaccines ended disease. All these other reasons were there before them. These are not made-up charts. These are official government charts. So any doctor, any scientist, any public health official could have done this, and they didn't. It shows the vaccinated and unvaccinated, and they're virtually even in the vaccinated and unvaccinated. The unvaccinated actually were dying at less levels. So this chart is now published, or today will be published, on GaryNall.com, my Facebook, and Progressive Radio Network. So finally, you have hard scientific public health data. So I want to share that. Now, segueing from that, I'm going to quote verbatim from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who we just filmed, for a new documentary I have coming up on vaccinations. This is my third documentary on vaccines. And the point of the documentary is very simple. I ask four questions to all the experts, and the only people I have in the film are board-certified physicians and scientists. And I ask this question, are vaccines safe? If so, where's your evidence? Are they not safe? If so, where's your evidence? Are they effective? Where's your evidence? If they're not effective, where's your evidence? That's the entire film. And it's a phenomenally interesting look at immunology. I went to the professors of immunology, chairmen of the Department of Immunology, and asked, is vaccination the same as immunization? Because we talk about immunization, immunizing a public, but we're really vaccinating a public. Does vaccine impart guaranteed lifelong immunity? And the answer was no, in every single instance. And by the way, a lot of these people are still pro-vaccine. That's the irony. And then I get into the whole psychology of belief systems as a part of this. Here's what one of the people I interviewed had to say. I'm quoting verbatim, the tendency of a max vaccination program is to herd people. People are not cattle or sheep. They should not be herded. A mass vaccination program carries a built-in temptation to oversimplify the problem, to exaggerate the benefits, to minimize or completely ignore the hazards, to discourage or silence scholarly, thoughtful, and cautious opposition, to create an urgency where none exists, to whip up an enthusiasm among citizens that can carry with it the seeds of impatience, if not intolerance, to extend the concept of police power of the state to quarantine far beyond its proper limitation, to assume simplicity when there is actually great complexity, to continue to support a vaccine long after it has been discredited, to ridicule honest and informed consent. There's plenty of confusion on the topic of vaccination, especially amongst brainwashed doctors who trusted their medical schools. Then the unsuspecting, trusting public trusts them because the medical establishment must know best, right? And doctors are nice people trying to do a good job, right? I was once one of those brainwashed doctors who believed in the benevolence of the medical system and believed that all I learned was the best that modern times had to offer. It is blazingly clear to me now, though, that much of what is taught in medical school is enormously limited. I now see that most doctors are little more than blind slave technicians who follow the dogma they were taught and were rewarded for repeating, even as the truth unfolds in front of them, dictating otherwise. Unbeknownst to most doctors, the polio vaccine history involves a massive public health service makeover during an era when a live, deadly strain of poliovirus infected the salt vaccine and paralyzed hundreds of children and their contacts. These were the vaccines that were supposedly responsible for the decline in polio from 1955 to 1961, but there's a more sinister reason for the decline in polio during those years. In 1955, a very creative redefinition of poliovirus infection was invented to cover up the fact that many cases of polio paralysis had no poliovirus in their systems at all. And while this protected the reputation of the salt vaccine, it muddied the waters of history in a big way. Even during the peak epidemics, unifactorial poliovirus infection resulting in long-term paralysis was a very low incident disease that was falsely represented as a rampant and violent crippler by Basil O'Connor's March of Dimes advertising campaigns. At the same time as Basil O'Connor was pulling in $45 million a year to fund the salt vaccine development, scientists started to realize that other viruses like Coxsackie, Echo, enteroviruses could also cause polio. They also discussed the fact that lead, arsenic, DDT, and other commonly used neurotoxins could identically mimic the lesions of polio. During the great epidemics in the United States, the pathology called polio was reversed by alternative medical doctors who attested to great success using detoxification procedures available at the time, yet they were categorically ignored. Now it is admitted in the medical literature that other viruses can cause polio, yet few people on the street have any idea. Prior to 1954, the following undoubtedly hid behind the name poliomyelitis: transverse myelitis, viral or aseptic meningitis, GBS, that's what Franklin Delano Roosevelt had, Chinese paralytic syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, epidemic cholera, cholera morbus, spinal meningitis, inhibitory palsy, intermittent fever, famine fever, worm fever, bilious remittent fever, post-polio syndrome, acute flaccid paralysis. Indeed, the umbrella term acute flaccid paralysis are poliomyelitis and transverse myelitis, and GB syndrome, and enteroviral encephalopathy, and traumatic neuritis, and Reye syndrome, etc. So before you believe that polio had been eradicated, just look at the graphs from the actual public health statistics And you'll see that, gee whiz, instead of going down from 1996 to 2010, all of these conditions increased substantially. From 15,000 cases in 1996 to 100,000 cases in 2010. So when people ask me where all the children are with their iron lungs, I would answer that they should ask Dr. Douglas Kerr from Johns Hopkins, who stated on page 15 in the foreword to Donna Jackson Nakawa's book, The Autoimmune Epidemic. Quote, infants as young as 5 months old can get transverse myelitis, and some are left permanently paralyzed and dependent upon a ventilating machine to breathe. My colleagues at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and I hear or treat hundreds of new cases every year, end quote. Does the public have any idea that there are hundreds of cases of something that would once have been called polio, and some of those children will be dependent on a modern version of the iron lung to breathe? No, they do not. Parents today think that the Salk vaccine eliminated any need for ventilators because the pictures of all these children on iron lungs are no longer paraded in front of people in order to create fear. Besides which, today's iron lungs don't look like a prototype submarine. They're barely recognizable as today's ventilators. The polio vaccine had the fastest licensing in FDA history. It was approved for commercial production after only 2 hours. That's right, 2 hours of deliberation amongst the licensing committee. In a pressured environment, the scientists witnessed a vaccine that was escorted to market before academic and community doctors had a chance to read any published reports on the safety studies, and before the results of the big polio vaccine trial made it into any medical journal. If these scientists had had more say, it is likely that the disaster would of all these earlier events of contaminated vaccines that led to crippling and death from of the vaccine recipients just weeks following the hurried vaccine licensing could have been averted. Previously, the vaccine had been distributed as an experimental product, not a licensed product. The committee was asked to come to a decision very quickly. There were discussions of the report that Dr. Francis had given, but we were not in a position to discuss it very intensely because we had not seen the report prior to this morning, and the report was distributed to us after the presentation. We were pressured in the sense that we were told that speed was essential, and when we came up towards 5 p.m., some of us felt, well, we would like to discuss this matter more. We were told that to discuss the matter further, it would have to go into the following week, and we would have to go to Washington or Bethesda, and most of the members were unwilling to do so. We were, in effect, pressured into an earlier decision than we ordinarily would have made. It was part of the pressure of events, put it that way, end quote. And that is only the beginning of the polio story, the likes of which currently serve as the foundation of modern belief in vaccination, even by those who may have doubts regarding current vaccine policy. No vaccines are safe. Having efficacy means an antibody response is generated, not that they keep you from getting sick. There are many other ways to keep children healthy other than injecting them with the disease matter and chemicals, animal DNA, animal proteins, detergents, and surfactants that inflame and weaken the blood-brain barrier, potentially causing inflammation and other problems. Do you know how much doctors learn about vaccines in medical school? When we participate in pediatrics training, we learn that vaccines need to be given on schedule. We learn that smallpox and polio were eliminated by vaccines. We learn that there's no need to know how to treat diphtheria because we don't see it anymore. We are indoctrinated into the mantra that vaccines are safe and effective, neither of which is true. Doctors today are given extensive training in how to talk to hesitant parents, how to frighten them by vastly inflating the risks during natural infection. They are trained on the necessity of twisting parents' arms to conform or fire them from their practices. Doctors are trained that nothing bad should be said about any vaccine. Historically, it was commonplace since the times of the deadly smallpox vaccines to discourage your silent, scholarly, thoughtful, and cautious opposition to mass vaccination policies. This is politics, plain and simple. In the environment of cronyism and corporatism that has invaded the supposed health care industry, the opinions of learned anti-vaccination doctors are not permitted on CNN and Fox News or in the mainstream literature, probably because if they were broadcast on such media outlets, the unsuspecting public would do an about-face. Instead, the publicity that mainstream media concedes often involves a parent who is opposed to vaccination after a child becomes vaccine-injured, matched up with a celebrity talking doctor. Dr. Stork had an all-out tantrum after J.B. Handley got some sense interjected from the audience during Jenny McCarthy's appearance on television. For now, let's just ignore Dr. Sears' utter delusion over the history of vaccination and the decline in infectious disease. Having J.B. Handley on the program with the audience clapping for him without editing him was an unusual event. The standard approach on commercial television is to pretend there is no anti-vaccination doctor to match the celebrity doctor or those of the Paul Offit gendre. Therefore, they can only invite and publicly defeat those whom they underestimate. Cheers to JB for getting an edge in. This is simply how the game of vaccination has always been played. Keep the opinions of thoughtful and informed doctors and scientists out of the way of the cameras and the peer-reviewed journals and only allow the anti-vaccine perspective in limited representation. If you have doubts on the safety and effectiveness of vaccinations, please keep your curiosity up since the lives of your children may depend upon it. You will probably have much deprogramming to do, just like most of us had. And that is from Dr. Jeffries. One last thing, and this comes from Dr. Russell Blaylock. It's short. This was sent to me from Eileen Danneman, and the director of the National Coalition of Organized Women. Quote, herd immunity myth by Dr. Russell Blaylock, board-certified neurosurgeon, that vaccine-induced herd immunity is mostly myth can be proven quite simply. When I was in medical school, we were taught that all the childhood vaccines lasted a lifetime. This thinking existed for over 70 years. It was not until relatively recently that it was discovered that most of these vaccines are effective only for 2 to 10 years after being given. What this means is that at least half the population, that is the baby boomers, have had no vaccine-induced immunity against any of these diseases for which they have been vaccinated early in life. At least 50% of the population has been unprotected for decades. If we listen to present-day wisdom, we are all at risk of resurgent massive epidemics should the vaccination rate fall below 95%. Yet we all have lived for at least 40 years with 50% or less of the population having vaccine protection. Herd immunity has not existed in this country for many decades, and no resurgent epidemics have occurred. Vaccine-induced herd immunity is a lie used to frighten doctors and public health officials and other medical personnel and the public into accepting vaccinations. End quote, Dr. Russell Blaylock. I'm Gary Nall. Now for some commentaries. That was our health segment. First up, for those of you using the iPod who think that all things new and technical are just wonderful. Well, the technology certainly may allow you to do things creatively and communicate. There's no disputing that. But does it matter to you, or should it matter to anyone, how something is produced and the consequences to the people who are engaged in that? If on one hand, making the product that benefits you brings billions, tens of billions of dollars a year in profits to the manufacturers, hence the stockholders and the investors are very well suited to benefit, should we look at the consequences? This is from Aram Gupta, Alternet. Apple's sordid business practices are even worse than you think. I'll quote this. Behind the sleek face of the iPod is an ugly backstory that has revealed once more the horrors of globalization. The buzz about Apple's sordid business practices is courtesy of a series of investigations that show that iPod is assembled from child labor, toxic shop floors, involuntary overtime, suicidal working conditions, and preventable accidents that kill main workers. It turns out the story is much worse. Researchers with the Hong Kong-based Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior say that legions of vocational and university students, some as young as 16, are forced to take months-long internships in Foxconn's mainland China factories assembling Apple products. The details of the internship program paint a far more disturbing picture than even the New York Times does of how Foxconn, quote, the Chinese hell factory, treats its workers, relying on public humiliation, military discipline. That means standing out in the sun in perfect attention for hours at a time with no water. Now, just as an aside, could you imagine asking every single employee of any corporation, any business in the United States to go outside, stand in the sun with no water in military attention for hours on end? There's forced labor. There's a physical abuse as management tools to hold down the cost, hence extracting more profit for Apple. To supply enough employees for Foxconn, the 60th largest corporation globally, government officials are serving as lead recruiters at the cost of pushing teenage students into harsh work environments. And the scale is mind-numbing. Just last year alone, over 100,000 new vocational and university students were forced to work at Foxconn or they couldn't graduate from school. And Foxconn, according to Ross Perlman, author of Intern Nation, told Alternate, quote, Foxconn is conspiring with government officials and universities in China to run what may be the world's single largest intern program and one of the most exploitive. Students at vocational schools, including those whose studies have nothing to do with consumer electronics, are literally forced to move far from home to work for Foxconn. And by the way, they build gigantic structures where people have zero privacy and frequently are working 16-hour days, 7 days a week, nonstop. It's profitable. Apple's profit the last quarter was $13 billion. Foxconn has 420,000 employees. A lot of them commit suicide. And everyone at Apple and its management and top ranks knows this. All the companies that make their products at Foxconn know this. There's no secret. Isn't this corporate socialism? The use of hundreds of thousands of students is one way in which China's state regulates labor in the interest of Apple. Other measures, including banning independent unions, enforcing a household registration system that denies migrants social services, and hence no political rights. So, this is how they make their money. Just be aware of that. These are the wages of misery. So when you buy a product, ask yourself, do you have any moral responsibility to ask yourself, was this product made by fair trade? And if it wasn't, then the next time you see someone who is protesting and may protest for the right reasons and the right cause, and if they're wearing Nike sneakers and eating McDonald's and are so filled with contempt for those who are hypocrites, and all the while they're working on their iPod, ask them which part of globalization are they really against? Separately, this is to Bill O'Reilly. Mr. O'Reilly, I fear that you were born at the wrong time. I think that you would have been extremely well placed if you were leading the Inquisition in 1296. This kind of self-righteousness, especially in the moral theater, where you have people on to talk about their religion and using their religion as a basis for faith-based initiative, getting politicians elected, and causing laws that they don't like because their religious belief to become the law of the land, means that there is no separation of church and state. And historically, these individuals have tried to believe that our founding fathers wanted us to be a Christian nation. Nothing could be further from the truth, and we've gone through that history lesson several times. So I'd like to share some thoughts from Valerie Tarico from Alternet and myself involving this. On the one hand, take a look at who we are as a nation. We are very diverse. There are over 30,000 different Christian denominations in the United States. And we have them at all levels. And more often than not, a person will use what they call their Bible believing. And that's particularly true among the Bible literalists, people who literally will tell you that what's in the Bible is the Word of God. And therefore, they are sticking to the Word of God. And that's what allows them then to take the Word of God from the Bible and to play that into the body politic and to listen to people such as Rick Perry or Mitt Romney or Rick Sanitarium, and that's where he belongs, because these people are so pandering to this. And they just keep jumping backwards and doing hoops. Well, show me where in the American Constitution or an American legal system the founding principles were based upon the Bible. I'd like to see it. Now, mind you, a lot of Christians, including those like myself who grew up in small communities, are not Bible literalists, but instead examine the Bible as a record of our imperfect spiritual ancestors who struggled to understand what is good and what is not good. Now, if you ascribe what is good as godly and what if you ascribe what is not good as evil, that is your business. But all of this means that are we better able to live a moral, ethical, and honorable life today because of the strength of our religious teachings? Well, it depends upon each individual. And some the answer is yes, and some it is no. But then you start talking about who you have on your show. Even though divorce and teenage pregnancy rates are lower in more secular parts of the country, Bible believers see both as problems caused primarily by America's loss of faith. To hear them tell it, from the time of America's founding until the 1970s, when we became a more promiscuous nation, though I do not believe that is the case, I myself found that only about 2% of the American heterosexual community were engaged in sexual liberation practices, and a small percentage on college campuses. But because the media focused on it, it overblew the issue. So you would think that everybody was having sex all the time with anyone and everyone. It simply wasn't the case. That was also true in the gay community. Only about 2% were fast-track gays. But that was the emphasis, the bathhouses and the night scene and the multiple sexual partners. But that wasn't true for the average person who was heterosexual or who was gay. There is something that I believe that we should understand. My experience tells me that most of the people who are Bible believers rarely read the Bible, or they're very selective in what they read. And if they did, they would know that the Bible model of sex and marriage has little to do with anything being spoken about today. For example, let's be specific now. You're a true believer in the Bible. You believe everything in there is the Word of God, and therefore you're willing to follow that above all other laws. Okay. How are you going to reconcile the Bible recommending rape, incest, master-slave sexual relations, captive virgins? Now, just because a story is told in the Bible doesn't mean it's intended as a model for devout behavior. You also have to ask, did your God command or forbid the behavior? If the behavior is punished and if Jesus subsequently indicates the rules have changed in the New Testament, then do you just believe in the New Testament? Well, through this lens, you find that God of the Bible still endorses polygamy and sexual slavery, coerced marriage of young virgin girls, along with monogamy. In fact, he endorses all three to the point of providing detailed regulations based upon stories of sex and marriage that God rewards and appears to approve. One might add incest to the mix. Nowhere does the Bible say, quote, don't have sex with someone who doesn't want to have sex with you. Furthermore, none of the norms that are endorsed and regulated in the Old Testament law, polygamy and sexual slavery and coerced marriage of young girls, are revised or reversed or even condemned by Jesus. In fact, the writer of Matthew puts these words, hence, do not think that I have come to abolish the law of the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke or the pen will by any means disappear from the law of the Old Testament until everything is accomplished. Matthew 5:17-18. That's the New Testament. The law of which Jesus speaks is the law of Moses or the Torah. And anyone who claims the Bible as the perfect word of an omnipotent, omnibenevolent God should have at least the temerity to read it carefully. In point of fact, polygamy is the law of the Old Testament and accepted in the New Testament. In fact, there are at least 40 biblical figures, each of whom had multiple wives. Example, Abraham and Isaac. King David and the first king of Israel had 8 wives, but his son Solomon was supposed to have been the wisest man who ever lived, had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Kings 1 and 11. Concubines, well, do you know what a concubine is? All throughout the Bible. They're sex slaves. And the Bible gives instructions on acquisition of several types of sex slaves. In the book of Numbers 31:18, God's servant commands the Israelites to kill all the used Midianite women who have been captured in war and all the boy children, but to keep all the virgin girls for themselves. The law of Moses spells out a purification ritual to prepare a captive virgin for life as a concubine. It requires her owner to shave her head and trim her nails and give her a month to mourn her parents before the first sex act. Deuteronomy 21:12. A Hebrew girl who is raped can be sold to her rapist for 50 shekels, or about $850, Deuteronomy 22:28. He must then keep her as one of his own wives for as long as she lives. A man might acquire multiple wives, whether he wanted them or not, if his brother died. In fact, if his brother dies with no children, it becomes a duty to impregnate his wife. In the book of Genesis, Onan is struck dead by God because he fails to fulfill this duty, preferring to spill his seed on the ground, meaning he masturbated, instead of creating offspring with his brother's wife. Genesis 38:8. And so it goes. So remember, for those who believe that our laws should be based upon biblical laws, and that our founding fathers wanted us to be a Christian nation, and that those who deviate from the law of the good book are deviants, you better do your homework first and then see, do you really know, or do you really want to know what it is that you're supporting? I'm Gary Knoll. That's a commentary based upon Bill O'Reilly last night having a group of people on to talk about why we should not allow sexual prostitution to be legalized and should not allow legalizing drugs because it somehow would undermine our moral authority, and why the conservative view of our religious philosophy is so important, and therefore it is completely acceptable for anyone in any religion to promote a political agenda to the congregation. Okay, that's fine. But just in the next time, have someone on who can actually quote Scripture to those who claim the right of Scripture, and let's see how they're going to dance around the Word of God, supporting slavery and rape and incest and murder. I'd be happy to engage in that debate. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to our interview segment of our program now. My guest is Dan Olmstead. I mentioned earlier in the program he is an investigative reporter, formerly a senior editor for UPI, a graduate of Yale, and a founding staff member of USA Today, where he served as an assistant national editor. And he writes about health and medicine regularly in the Washington Times, currently an editor of the Age of Autism website, which provides daily updates on the autism epidemic. The Columbia Journalism Review has called the site some of the most enterprising contributions to the autism debate. And he is also, along with colleague Mark Blaxall, the author of Age of Autism, Mercury, Medicine, and Man-Made Epidemics, Nice to have you with us today, Dan.
Thanks, Gary. Good to see you.
Dan,
over the phone.
Dan, a couple of items. A Stanford University School of Medicine study with twins claims that that the genes only account for 38% of autism spectrum disorder risk, whereas 62% is due to environmental factors. Then the Environmental Working Group has come down on the failure of government and federal health agencies to deal with the rising exposure to children to mercury and toxic chemicals in our environment, from fossil fuels to coal burning. Would you please address the debate about aligning the whole autism debate, that it's strictly genetic and hence hereditary and hence blaming the parents and saying no one's at fault and therefore not covering these people, versus looking honestly at what the reality of parents and children who have developed autism, who didn't have autism at the beginning of their life, or any of those who were developing normally until their exposure to environmental contaminations, including vaccines, and then they became autistic, and the government has refused up to this point, and the public health officials, to acknowledge this. Please take us on this journey.
Well, you know, just to start off, it's beginning to feel like Groundhog Day in March every couple of years, because the CDC comes out with another round of terrifying figures on the autism rate and continues to say they don't know what's going on, but it can't be the environment or it can't be vaccines in the environment, and whatever it is a big mystery. Yesterday they came out with a rate of 1 in 88 children who were born in the year 2000, so they're 12 years old now, have some kind of autism disorder. When you break that down, boys and girls, boys are much more likely to have autism, and you get a situation where in New Jersey, 1 in 28 boys, 12 years old now, has an autism diagnosis. And when I was in school, at least, the 28 was a typical number for a grade school class. So you're looking at just a very, very powerful figure there, and especially when you think that back 20 or 30 years ago, it was like 1 in 2,500 or so children would have autism. Now it's somewhere around in the range of 1 in 100. That's a 25 times, not 25%, 25 times more common. It's horrifying, and what that has to mean to anybody who's looking at it with an open mind is that genes can only play a small role. They may predispose a child to having some problem with an environmental toxin. Maybe they can't get rid of the mercury, or maybe they're prone to autoimmune disorders because those run in their family. But really, ever since autism was first described in 1943, parents who are the victims have been the target of blame one way or the other. First, it was this really horrendous idea that mothers in particular were so cold, refrigerator parents, that they inspired this reaction in their child of withdrawing completely into this autistic self-imposed exile. In fact, Bruno Bettelheim wrote a book called The Empty Fortress as late as 1964, which was the orthodoxy that, you know, the child had kind of disappeared under this onslaught of parental rage. It was nuts. That was succeeded by what seemed to be a gentler theory, which was that it had to be genetic if it wasn't caused by the parental behavior. And that, you know, seemed for a time to be reasonable. But then what happened, as we know, again, is starting in the late 80s, there was this huge increase in the autism rate, and now you can parse it over, you know, is it part of it better diagnosis? Well, maybe some small part is. Is part of it a broadening to include Asperger's? Possibly. But this many-fold increase clearly debunks any connection with the genes as the driving force. What happened late last year was a study that came out of Stanford and actually the NIH, National Institutes of Health, that found that the studies that had pointed towards genes were really faulty. In order to have a genetic disorder, essentially, if you had identical twins and one had it, then the other one would have to have it because it would be 100% genetic. And fraternal twins, the rate would be a lot less because they, you know, although they're, you know, born from the same mother, their genetic material is no more common than another sibling. But what this study found was that the concordance rate of autism in identical twins was far lower than it had been described. You know, previous studies had said it was 95% concordance in identical twins. One had autism, so would the other. In fact, it was more like 43%. And, you know, by the same token, fraternal twins had a higher rate of autism. So the whole thing just blew up. But we're still hearing this nonsense about genes and this denial of an epidemic.
Where do we go from here? What is the next step?
Well, Gary, you know, I actually find myself thinking just how much longer can this cover-up of the truth continue? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm trying to make it as short as possible time before the truth comes out, and so are, you know, many other people who've been working at it a lot longer than I have with much more at stake, you know, parents and families and advocacy groups. But we know that younger parents, younger doctors are, you know, catching on to the fact that a lot of this is medically induced. A lot of it is vaccine induced. I mean, I know that's not popular to say in the mainstream, but it's the truth. And so, you know, I think a generation of autocratic, paternalistic, you know, Western allopathic doctors are going to have to get off the stage. And the same thing with a lot of journalism that has been so, you know, badly amiss in doing their job of talking to real people, talking to parents, talking to families, listening to these stories about what's happened. So, you know, where do we go from here is just fight, you know, do the right thing, possibly lose every war and every battle and win the war, you know, like the Viet Cong. I mean, I don't want to compare myself to the fighting guerrilla army.
We understand the metaphor.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, again, I thank you for giving us this newsmaker update. Sooner or later, we're going to have to appreciate how toxic the environment is. I believe that one of the reasons we have not been honest about the real causes of autism spectrum disorder is because we would then have to take an honest look at the pollutants in our environment, the chemicals in our food supply, all the pesticides, all of the industrial solvents that we allow today because we don't want to burden the manufacturers, the major political contributors, with having to clean up their mess. So if we simply say this is not a possible cause, then we're left with just genes, and we know that that is not the case. And so until such time that we have more progressive minds in positions of power to regulate properly, we're going to end up with this mess. The Age of Autism, Mercury, Medicine, and Man-Made Epidemics from St. Martin's Press. Dan, thank you very much for sharing this with us.
You bet, Gary. Best wishes.
Bye. Now, coming up in a moment, your calls, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Any of the things you've heard us talking about, please call in and share your points of view. We're going to speak with Jason in a moment in the studio. And then a coming attractions, we have not one, not two, but three conversations with remarkable minds coming at you next week. That's correct. We have some outstanding people that you're going to be exposed to, including Dr. Ross Jackson, one of the world's foremost futurists and visionaries. And he'll be visiting our studios from his home in Denmark for a more philosophical conversation about the economics, geopolitics, false science that is leading civilization to a tipping point and the visionary efforts to reverse that. Then we're going to have a conversation with why does the controversial biblical book of Revelations continue to be held in such high esteem throughout the ages to predict events that have never come to pass? World-renowned Princeton University scholar in the origins of Christianity and Gnosticism, Professor Elaine Pagels will be our guest to deconstruct this text and place it into proper historical perspectives, which will certainly shock many literalist Christians. And then award-winning war journalist Douglas Weising, who has reported from Afghanistan, will share with us his extraordinary research into how the U.S. taxpayers have bankrolled the Taliban in the past, and we continue to do that today. That's coming up. Your calls are coming next here, and Jason will be in the studio. A special. This is our only special this week, and I haven't offered this. I don't think I've ever offered this. And this is the deepest discounted offer I believe I've ever given. Chewable Power Berry Blast. I'll bet you didn't even know I had one. This has got the proprietary blend of Camu, Aronia, black currant, blackberry, pomegranate, ellagic acid, and blueberries, strawberries, Hawaiian noni, pineapple, guava, apple, orange, raspberry, mango, mangosteen, goji, acai, capucca, black soybean hull extract, blue corn meal, tart cherry, cranberry concentrate, wild bilberry, green tea, watermelon, hawthorn, grape skin, grape seed, plum, prune, elderberry, beet juice, oat bran, all that, it makes it a chewable. You can chew these, tasty. Here's the deal. Normally, this would cost you, for two of these, $170. Get this. This is it. $49.95. You heard me right. I'm offering two for the price of one, but even less than that. You're not paying for, you're paying not $170, you're paying $49.95. That's a savings of over $100. That's the deepest percentage of discount I'm aware that I've given. Give a call now for your chewable Powerberry Blast. A limit of two to a person. That's it. You can get one and get, you're getting two bottles for $49.95. They are normally, I think, $80, $89 each. You're getting two for $49. This is it. Call 212. Let me know. No, what is my number? 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. The most you can get is two bottles, all right, because otherwise we'll run out. Because I'm with the biggest, deepest discount I've ever given on anything. This is it. 877-627-5065. Now, let's say hello to Carl from Los Angeles. Carl, you're on.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
I read a book a long time ago called The Myth of Heterosexual AIDS, and I'm wondering if you've ever heard of it or the author Michael Fumento.
I've heard of Michael. I have not read the book. I'm sorry I haven't, but if you send me anything you have on it, I'll be happy. When I get back to New York in 8 weeks, I'll be happy to read it, and then I can comment on it. I couldn't otherwise. But if you're asking, is being heterosexual or having heterosexual sex in the way that most people would have heterosexual sex without amyl nitrate and without strong rectal intercourse, then show me the cases of heterosexual sex where you've infected a person heterosexually, and then compare that to what we know are the principal people causes of AIDS-related diseases in fast-track gays, in intravenous drug users, and in hemophiliacs, and that is still true today as it was then. I was just looking at something like this recently. And let's say hello to Myron. Myron is our media director, and he's here to give you good news about our brand-new, completely rehauled website, and also there's been news in the media about how many people are switching off. Today, it was CNN. 50% of all CNN's audience has been gone in the last 12 months. 17% of Fox's audience has gone in the last 17 months, or last 12 months. 90% of WBA audience is gone. 90%. It was first down to about 78% in the last book, month to month, and then it went down again. So the audience in the morning is just hundreds instead of tens of thousands. So it's just amazing. The question is, why are so many people abandoning so many of the traditional left and the traditional right radio stations, television stations? And yet we're just seeing, I think, a 70% increase in audience recently, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. The question is, why?
That's right. It's pretty amazing, Gary. It's pretty amazing, Gary, I got to say. I mean, we're seeing basically the same amount of people, almost down to the percentage, that are leaving all these major networks, not viewing those anymore. They understand that they're just getting all these biased news reports. We're seeing the same, almost exactly the same percentage coming over to Progressive Radio Network. So I think that that's not a coincidence.
Myron, you represent a voice of reason within the younger generation, those in their teens and 20s and 30s. give us your idea of why you believe so many people are turning off these historically solid areas. Even like BAI wasn't growing, but it kept its audience for a while. But now it's just, I've never seen in the history of being on the radio an audience lose a loss that is that great. And CNN losing 50%, which means it's going to lose a lot of its advertisers because the advertising rates are based upon the size of your audience and specific demographics. Give us your perspective.
Well, I think that my generation, I'm 30 years old right now, and I think that my generation is just sick and tired of being told the same exact thing. It's like a factory churning out these news stories and these political viewpoints that are outdated. They've been outdated for 20 years almost, and you know, we just know how the deal works. They know how their sausage is made, and they think that by pandering to the special interest groups on the left or on the right, that they're just going to keep things going. And their whole aim is to sell commercial space, right? So, I mean, I think that people who have been exposed to that their whole lives are starting to see through it. You know, they thought that they could get away with keeping on doing it, status quo, but people see through it. They know you can predict what Fox is going to say about any subject, what BAI is, where they're going to fall on it, you know, and we don't want to be told the same thing over and over again. We want to be challenged. We want to think for ourselves.
We have Jason also in studio, the program director for Progressive Radio. Jason, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it. I would just like to thank all our audience because we just did a year analysis now that we just changed over to our new website. From February to the end of February, in 1 year, we went weekly. We averaged over 60,000 new listeners. We averaged, that's an amazing average, plus with unique, just new visitors visiting us every day, we're averaging close to 5,000 new people joining us every day. So we'd like to thank all our listeners for the great support they've given us, and we're only going to get better. So please stay with us.
For both of you, I'd like to give a brief overview why I believe this is happening. I believe that an entire younger generation is realizing that they have been misled, propagandized, and have been commodified, that they're not seen as having any value outside of purchasing something or supporting something. I believe for those who are a little older, that they're seeing that the institutions they trusted have betrayed them. They've sold them out. I see a lot of union members who believe that their unions sold them out with NAFTA and GATT and supporting the Democrats, which were corporate Democrats instead of the historical Democrats. I believe that a lot of conservatives and libertarians feel that they were sold out again by the corporatists who didn't look at what it meant to have an effective but smaller and functional government and more rights to the people and more rights that give them a sanctity of life rather than having everything micromanaged by a federal government to where you had to fear the government as we do today because of the excesses they've taken in taking away our constitutional rights. And then you start to look, well, where can I go to get information? And historically, if you went to the networks, NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, or CNN, you were given the same information. They all covered the same stories and pretty much cover them in the same way with their own in-house ideologues. And they bring in only those experts time and again, the same tired faces, same tired voices to tell us a particular point of view, which is not education, it's not challenging, it's not scholarly, it's simply propaganda. On the other end, the alternative media, like Pacifica, it didn't grow to meet the larger demands, and especially those younger people. It was like either a KPFA in Berkeley, which is old and hippie, or in New York, very radical and very, very racially sensitive, and not taking into account what's really hip and new. You can't succeed if you feel like everything in life makes you a victim. You got to get beyond that. And so when people start to realize now over the Internet, there are other resources, other articles to read that are really good, cutting-edge articles, radio shows to listen to, television to watch, documentaries to inform you, support groups, that they switched over. And now the largest single group in America are the independents. And of those independents, some come from a conservative background, some come from a liberal background, but they all come because they're tired of being talked down to and, in effect, not acknowledged. That's why I believe that today we have a viable, growing Internet that with some of the sharpest minds in the world, you will never hear or see these on the regular or even on the alternative because they don't fit their political dynamic. And indeed, if you don't fit the political and racial dynamic of a Pacifica, you don't get on either as a guest or as a host. The same is true for Fox. The same is true for MSNBC or the same is true now for Current. So where does that leave people who want independent information that is not talking about a celebrity news or talking about the same tired political nonsense over and over again. And that's why I believe that we're growing. Others like us are growing. And that's why now we've added hundreds of articles a week that are all progressive in every area. Progressive environmental, progressive on religious, progressive on spiritualist, progressive on self-help. Because that's what people want. So those are just my points of view.
That's
final
right.
thoughts from you, too.
I just want to say that I agree 100% with what you're saying. And I think that our main goal here is not to pander to any special interests. We're not liberal. We're not conservative. We just want great radio, one. And two, we want information that's going to empower people, no matter where it comes from. So we have an Occupy the Hood radio show here. We have also a libertarian news show. We have health shows. We have spirituality shows. We have shows for the younger audience. We have a guy from National Lampoon who has a show on Thursday nights. And we also have, satire. And we also have lifestyle shows, what it's like to live in Latin America. I mean, it's pretty unique content, and that's why people keep coming, because they realize that we're not going to just sit here and tell you what you should think. We're going to empower you to think for yourself.
Well, give people resources that get them to be able to take a step in their life, and that's important. Thank you very much, Myron. Thank you, Jason, and thank all of you for listening. I'm Gary Noll. Stay tuned for Danny Schechter, the News Dissector, and he is one of the most popular programs on Progressive Radio Network, and he's coming at you in just 60 seconds.